In other words, we want time off for good behavior. Is that really what women want from men? Actually, when I was reading Kogan's remarks, I couldn't help but realize, hey, I kind of want those things too. I too want time off for good behavior. I too want someone to appreciate what I do, even if what I do are simple routines of life. Did my dear wife notice that I did the dishes? Did she notice that I took out the trash, or did the laundry, or cooked dinner, emptied the litter box, did the banking, and even vacuumed the rugs? It's so easy to get resentful over the fact that no one seems to appreciate what we do. Where in the world is the gratitude? Even when we make an effort to gain some appreciation, it seems so often that we fail. A woman may try a new hairstyle or a new dress only to have her husband, not even notice. A man might help out by washing the kitchen floor only to have his wife not even say thank you. What in the world must one do to be appreciated, we wonder? Where is the reward for all our sweat and toil? Honestly now, come on. Is that really how the world's supposed to work? Are we really in the business of being spouses, parents, grandparents, neighbors, even church members, only so we can get credit? The greatest danger to us is, however, when we start applying this appreciation-driven economy to our relationship with God. And please don't try and deny that you haven't done this, or at least contemplated it. The reasoning often goes something like this. Well, God, you know, I've prayed regularly for years. I go to church every week. I tithe and even give a little extra beyond my 10%. I'm good to my family, my cat, and my neighbors can really count on me. So God, because I've been so good and done my duties, how about healing my sick relative? Or maybe we think because we've been such a responsible Christian, we should get that job promotion or the house we've always wanted or that new car or whatever our hearts desire. This kind of thinking goes back to the old erroneous idea that God can somehow be manipulated into showering blessings on us simply because we do what we're supposed to do anyway. You know, pagan religions, that's how they do religion. They believe that if they sacrifice their firstborn or throw a virgin in a volcano, the god of their choice will smile on them. Our God, however, is never indebted to anyone. Never. And no matter how much we may try and plead or negotiate or coerce God, there is no cosmic bartering system in which we can buy blessings. It doesn't exist. To make that point clear to everyone, Jesus tells a parable. Suppose a servant has spent all day plowing fields in the hot sun or taking care of the master's sheep. The servant's very tired. He's sunburnt, he's hungry, he's thirsty. He'd like nothing better than to just sit down at his master's table and chow down on some food and maybe have a glass of wine, but that's not the case, is it? Before he can even nibble on a cracker, the servant must prepare his master's dinner. Now perhaps we've missed something in this little parable because of the cultural setting. In Jesus' day, the meal table was the most powerful symbol in a home. It is no accident that we are gathering today around the Lord's table. The master's table was the defining location of who was and was not considered part of the family. It would be very presumptuous for a servant to simply sit down and assume he was part of the family or was equal with the master. Actually, you know, the family dining table is something that's more important than maybe we have even thought. In the Toronto Star on Thursday, September the 27th, way back in 2007, there was a powerful article that appeared quoting an American study which revealed something that, frankly, many of us have suspected all along. The study found that teenagers, who ate dinner with their families, ate dinner with their families five or more times a week, were less likely to use drugs, to smoke, to drink alcohol, than their peers who ate with their families two times or less. The article goes on to say that 84% of teens surveyed would prefer to have dinner with their parents. The study's authors noted these are teenagers whose parents will tell you that they're difficult and they don't want to talk. But that's not the sense we're getting from the kids themselves. They prefer it. Suffice it to say that even today, the family dinner table is important. It's significant to the family unit. Powerful symbol. Perhaps the closest we could get to something similar in the parable would be a scenario where you've been working hard all day. You come home at the end of the day. You're really tired. You're ravenously hungry. Upon getting home, you discover, well, there's nothing really available to eat here that wouldn't take considerable preparation. So you decide, hey, let's go out for supper. At the restaurant, you sit down to order your meal. And the waiter goes off and tells the kitchen what we want. After a little while, the waiter returns with two sets of cutlery, two glasses of water, two cups of coffee, two napkins, and sets the table for two people. But you're sitting there alone. You think, oh, that's a little bit odd, but maybe the waiter assumes someone's coming or has made a bit of a mistake. After a short while, the waiter returns to your table with not only your dinner, but an extra plate of food, and then the waiter sits down across from you and begins to eat at your table. And the waiter, in between bites, asks, well, how was your day today? How's the family? And maybe even asks you how your love life is going. And you sit there in stunned silence. How can this be, you wonder? I'm the customer. The waiter's supposed to serve me, not sit at my table. How very presumptuous this waiter is. How presumptuous indeed. Jesus, though, isn't finished with the parable, is he? Not only does the servant not get to sit at the master's table or eat until the master is fed, but he doesn't even get thanked for working all day in the hot sun or for making the master's dinner. Oh, what an ingrate we might think about that master. Doesn't the master realize the effort that the servant has put out for him? In English, we have an idiom that might fit here. Couldn't the master have thrown the poor man a bone? Maybe just this once the master could have let the man sit at his table or make his own dinner first, or perhaps at least he could have just simply said thank you. Shouldn't he be granted, as Kogan suggests, time off for good behavior? Jesus replies to this line of thinking that if we feel that way, we've got it all wrong. Why should the servant receive any special blessing from his master for doing what he was supposed to do in the first place? The servant was doing what a servant does. Simply being a servant does not obligate the master to anything, not even an expression of gratitude. The servant has no grounds for any expectation on the master or any sense of equality with the master. Jesus' hearers who are familiar with masters and servants, they understand that point clearly. They get it. That's how the world works. In the same way. Whenever Jesus uses a phrase in the same way, we know the other shoe's going to drop. In the same way, when you obey me, you should say we are not worthy of praise. We are servants who have simply done our duty. I'm sure the disciples stood there in stunned silence. I'm sure that inside them there was this little voice that had been telling them that if they remained faithful to Jesus, they would surely get a great reward. However, as we learn from this parable, our relationship with God and Christ doesn't work that way. God cannot be bought by our piety. Every blessing, every good thing, every meaningful relationship we have is a gift of grace from God. We do not deserve it, nor can we demand it, because it's simply a free gift. When our Master Jesus invites us to his table, it isn't because we've done some amazing work in his name, but because he simply loves us and wants us to be with him. Jesus is certainly consistent of nothing else. In Matthew chapter 6, in the very heart of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus warns about the nature of rewards when he says this: "Take care. Don't do your good deeds publicly to be admired, because you will lose the reward from your Father in heaven. When you give a gift to someone in need, don't shout about it as the hypocrites do, blowing trumpets in the synagogues and streets to call attention to their acts of charity. I assure you, they have received all the reward they are ever going to get. But when you give to someone, don't tell your left hand what your right hand is doing. Give your gift in secret, and your Father, who knows all secrets, will reward you." I think it's all about significance. We all want to know that we're special. We probably want to know that we want to feel that we're even a little more special than someone else. It's all pride and vanity that would allow us to even consider our righteousness as being nothing more than filthy rags before God. That's exactly how God describes our futile efforts to justify our own works. In Isaiah 64 verse 6, Isaiah writes, "We are infected and impure with sin. When we proudly display our righteous deeds, we find they are filthy rags. Like autumn leaves, we wither and fall." That's quite a sobering thought to hear, isn't it? That all our good works are like autumn leaves that wither and dry up and blow away. All that effort to do what we conceive to be a good work, and here all along, it influences God not one iota. I read a story that told about a husband and wife who met with a marriage counselor. Back to men and women again. And they were having problems in their marriage with irreconcilable differences. And the husband explained it this way: "Ever since we were married, my wife has set out to change me. She convinced me to stop smoking, drinking, and staying out all night at parties. She got me to dress well and to enjoy the fine dining, classical music, and even the ballet. She even taught me how to save money and to invest my savings." Counselor considered all these sudden changes and then suggested, "It sounds like you may be experiencing latent bitterness towards your wife for so many behavioral changes all at once." The husband disagreed with the counselor. "Oh no, it's not at all like that. I like the changes. It's just that I have improved in so many ways that I don't think I'm good enough for her anymore." Or she's not good enough for me, sorry. Shall we be honest with ourselves, please? That there's at least a small part of us that is like that husband? when it comes to how we think God should view us? In all sincerity, we make the changes we know that we must to live as God wants us to, and then we adopt the posture of sitting back and expecting the blessings to just roll in. Maybe we've gone so far as to think that we're too good for God. That's something we would never say out loud. Heaven forbid. But maybe we think it. That like James and John, we feel we somehow earned the right for the privileged right and left hand spot at the master's table. In Philip Yancey's wonderful book called Prayer, Yancey makes the point that prayer, above everything else, is a realignment of one's truthful place in God's world. Prayer helps correct myopia. Yancey writes, calling to mind a perspective I daily forget, I keep reversing roles, thinking of ways in which God should serve me rather than vice versa. Prayer raises my sight beyond the petty circumstances of life to afford a glimpse of a lofty perspective. I realize my tininess and God's vastness and the true relationship of the two. In God's presence, I feel small because I am small. Later on, Yancey reminds his readers of the command of the psalmist. Psalm 46, verse 10. Who wrote, "Be still and know I am God." The Latin imperative for be still is the word vacate. Simon Tugwell explains, God invites us to take a holiday, vacation, to stop being God for a while and let God be God. Jesus is speaking today about knowing our place. And not elevating ourselves to an importance we just don't have. Perhaps that's why the disciples, they clamored for more faith. They begged Jesus, tell us how to get it. As if any effort on their part could gain them one speck of faith. Even if you had faith as small as a mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, may God uproot you and throw you in the sea, and it would obey you. Do you see Jesus' point? Miracles and faith and salvation have nothing to do with us, but everything to do with God. If you want mulberry trees to be uprooted and mountains to be thrown into the sea, then you can struggle your whole life with trying to do it on your own strength, and you will fail miserably. Or you can finally take a vacation. And stop interfering with God being God in your life. Remember that when we encounter God, we are very small because we are very small. But the good news is that God loves us anyway. And He's still willing to redeem us. Come. All you who are just tired of striving and struggling and feeling unappreciated and ignored. For unlike the master in the table, our master has pulled out a chair and he's invited us to join him around his table where he calls us his family.